I'm Are You Serious? And this is my show.
Natural disasters,
and eventually the end of the world. Are You Serious? We were just starting the Are You Serious show when the drugs began to take hold. I remember saying something like, I feel a little lightheaded. Maybe Steve Robles should host the show. And suddenly there was a terrible roar all around us, and the room was full of what looked like huge bats all swooping and screeching and diving around the studio. And a voice was screaming, "Holy Jesus, they've just eaten Diana Brown." B. Duke, the author and performer behind Gonzo, A Brutal Chrysalis, will be with us to talk and perform in just a bit. But first, I've got to tell you that Jeff Diehl is here, Steve Robles, Diana Brown, and Patton Oswalt is not here, but we're going to hear a track from his new album, and then we're going to talk about it.
At this point, Bush and Cheney have turned into the Dukes of Hazzard. Like, every week, they get themselves in these crazy predicaments where you're like, well, ain't no way the Duke boys are getting out of that one. And they fucking jump the General Lee over the Bill of Rights, and it's fucking insane. If the standard for impeachment is covering up a burglary or getting a blowjob, if that equals you're impeached, then shouldn't Bush have been executed at this point? Like, honestly, if that is, I'm just saying, if that's your standard, he should have been just beaten to death on the lawn of the White House with, like, Aerosmith playing and be like, yeah, fuck that guy, woo! Big monster truck rally and everyone drunk, yeah, fucking asshole. But nope, every week, just, they should just show him and Cheney walking through the Rose Garden and then freeze frame it and have Waylon Jennings come on and go, now can you believe these two guys covered up a child molester for 5 years? Ain't no way they getting out of this bucket of syrup. Squip it down and that bam. Can you believe these two draft dodgers sent men and women to die in the desert on a complete fucking lie? There ain't no way they gonna get out of this pickle.
Split dip dip dip.
Yeah, you can't add anything to what Patton Oswalt just said. I mean,
more just glory in his rightness.
Except I will have to say that it's been documented on this show that I have a weird, twisted obsession with Condoleezza Rice. In this scenario,
could she be the Jessica Simpson?
She would be Daisy Duke.
She's gonna be the
fucking
Daisy Duke.
Yeah.
And I can
I'm liking that.
See,
that's making my big toe spring up in my boot.
Well, then, hanging in hot pants.
Who's Roscoe P. Coltrane? Would that be?
That would be Rumsfeld.
Welcome to the Are You Serious casting.
No. Come on, Flash.
Who gets to be?
They're
Enos
on the other side. The Law. Who's the Law? Fitzgerald.
Gonzalez, I guess. Gonzalez would be Roscoe. Well, who'd
no,
be
no.
Boss Hogg?
Gonzalez is with.
Yeah, he's not.
The
he's not the Law.
Wait,
they have to give it to a Democrat, don't they?
You got to give it to like Nancy
I think they
Pelosi.
Have to
no, no.
Who,
who's the guy who?
Oh, the old guy.
Who's the guy who put those guys on trial?
I said Fitzgerald.
Cheney's assistant.
Fitzgerald.
Thanks.
That's what Jeff said.
F. Scott Fitzgerald. Yeah.
F. Scott Fitzgerald.
F. Scott Fitzgerald.
It wasn't even Fitzgerald. It's like Fitzsimmons.
Lock him in a room with Zelda for a while. That'll get him.
I don't know who Scott Fitzgerald is, but I agree. Let's F him.
So, I mean, did anybody even need to raise any serious points about this, or did he pretty much...
I'll tell you, talk about impeachment. I mean,
I'm
what the fuck?
I'm just reveling in the image of them jumping the General Lee over the Bill of Rights.
I was talking to Jeff privately.
You do that?
Yes.
What?
It's called pillow talk. I've got this weird feeling that, like, something really, really bad is going to happen with Bush. Like... And it's not even like an optimistic because I want to see him go down. I really
something's
do
gonna
feel like
to him or something's going to happen.
No,
us.
I think like another shoe is yet to drop, and really, it's going to fuck him royally. So I think the scenario that he's talking about, still might happen. I mean, if really? He
they're
really
beat the
pisses
crap
off,
out of him,
that, hey, look
in a public square.
Look what they did to fucking
with
what's
Eric
his
Smith playing?
Mussolini.
Yeah, Mussolini
hung by
and
the balls.
Codrescu. You know, they fucked those guys up, dragged them right out. And fucking,
I don't think. I don't
you're
think,
saying his day will come. I
don't think his day is going to come. He's not going to do time like Paris Hilton.
No, no, no.
Like
but politically, but politically. Oh, and
what would that have to be though in order to get people that angry? He's what is?
Yeah, see, I don't like.
I
what I'm saying. I'm not. I'm
game
not,
took a crap on my yeah. rug, raped my yeah. granddaughter, but I still think you know.
Yeah, hello.
Needed to be done, I guess.
Well, and the thing about it is,
killing our children isn't enough, apparently.
If, yeah, because
there's that 30% of the American people, no matter what he does. I
yeah,
they love him.
Because if you follow my scenario, it has to be something so amazingly like ridiculous, even in the context of what he's already pulled off, like. You know, Patton Oswalt was saying,
right.
like
child it, rape or something like that.
I mean, not that extreme, even, but just like really fucking like hand in the cookie jar, like real like smoking gun, Halliburton kind of like thing.
I don't pay as much attention to politics now as I did, you know, when things were a lot better. It's just like
we're just monkeys waiting for the next shock. It's now like, we've given up.
When people ask me what he's done, I can't remember because it's like. Too much, you know. You get this like cognitive haze.
Maybe he'll fart at this white tie fucking dinner with a queen, man. That would be great. Could you imagine?
Well, I mean, didn't his dad puke on the?
Yeah, the prime minister. But that's a different story. Than,
don't seem
that's
to
a different
it.
Story than farting next to the queen. I mean, come
well,
on.
Well, he did try to, you know, give,
goose that fucking German broad.
Oh, yeah, try to give.
Believe me, it's a look I know very, very well.
So for you, really, this is just to about Jeff. Getting Condi in the back of the General Lee.
Yeah, or in the front of the General Lee, for all I care.
Who's driving?
Who's driving?
All I know is we've driven this metaphor completely.
When the beam of light is broken by a solid object, such as this head, the electric eye control opens the faucet, and there's your drink.
B. Duke was shot from a cannon on August 20th, 2005. He landed in my backyard, and we raised him on belladonna tequila and chili dogs, and he grew. The thing grew, and today he is a freelance counterintelligence operative feared throughout the empire and certain precious gem syndicates. After giving notice to friends and family, he dove body, mind, and soul into Dr. Hunter S. Thompson. Recent sightings report... let me take it from there. Recent sightings report in South Dakota, Wyoming, Edmonton, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, and San Francisco read like confessions from some hideous corruption and conversion spree. He prefers LSD to all other drugs.
That's true.
I could go for that, I think. It's debatable, but and aggressive seduction to passive supplication.
That's
and
right.
I don't know if I'm going to do aggressive seduction or passive supplication today. But
you seem like a really nice guy, but you're just generally not my type.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. You know, I might change into something entirely otherwise after you finish drinking at the water we just served you.
My God,
you might,
man, what did you do?
You might.
Are you sure you put enough in?
You might notice that I look like a spider. But so describe the genesis of this show, Gonzo, Brutal Chrysalis.
My co-producer, A. Duke, came to me in July of 2005 and expressed some frustration with, you know, the tech situation and wanted to get out of life as a techie. And he'd done theater work before and he'd seen me do spoken word and other play performances in San Francisco. I did Dr. Strangelove and Night of the Living Dead at Spanganga. And
when you did Dr. Strangelove, you yes. basically performed the script or parts of the script or you reworked
the,
it?
The crew over at Spanganga, largely Jim Fornianis, and he had a partner at the time, really great guy too, had to split for Florida. But they took the entire movie and they reworked it onto a small stage there. Hmm. And a great cast, M.I. Blue and Shane Coon and Jim Fornianis was in there too.
So what was your role? Did you have the Peter Sellers?
I played Colonel Bat Guano, yeah. the man who holding the world for ransom due to a Coca-Cola machine.
Yeah.
And threatens Peter Sellers quite heavily with the Coca-Cola company if he doesn't get the president on the phone right now. But those were great opportunities. And so A called me up and said, you know, I think we should do a play together. And I said, well, what did you have in mind? He goes... I think we should do a play about Hunter Thompson, and I nearly hung up the phone on him. And he's been one of my best friends for over a decade, and so instead of hanging up the phone summarily, I said, I'll have to call you back, and hung up the phone on him. And I called him back in December. And I said,
now, why did you hang up the phone? Were you...
I was put off. One, I thought it was way too close to Thompson's checkout for us to be diving into something like that. It felt a little bit scavenger-like.
Ghoulish?
A bit, I think, yeah.
Thompson would dig it. Thompson would dig it, though, I think, if it's done right. I don't know. He might, depends on how it's done.
I'm a big kind of respect for the dead person, and even though he had a pretty good influence on my life from an early time, he wasn't exactly like the Godhead idol of my universe. And so we met in December, and I told him and C. Duke, our director and executive producer, that if they wanted to recreate Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, I was out right then.
Right.
And, that already been touched on, and then you had Where the Buffalo Roam, and, you know, right. Everybody had tried to capture that zany madness and that
right.
sort of zeitgeist, you know.
Right.
And so they asked what I had in mind, and I suggested that we go to Fear and Loathing in America, which is a collection of his letters, 68 to 76. And when I had read that a few years before, I became keenly aware of the fact that the nuances of a real man were there.
Right.
A great little history book called Don't Know Much About History once tried to lift the veil of lionized demigods by remembering that George Washington once said to Henry Ox Knox as he was crossing the river, Henry, shift your fat ass over, you'll swamp the whole boat. And the object of this man was to treat historical figures as real people, which they often are.
I love that. I mean, there is so much material from Hunter of him, like writing bitchy letters to people and notes.
He was ferocious. He would start in on speed probably somewhere around like 11 or midnight, and he would go to bed about 8 or 9 o'clock every day, around the time that Juan was getting up, his young son.
Right.
And he'd get up around 3 in the afternoon. And so most of these letters, and what I learned, we secured an original 1968 IBM Selectric Model 1 typewriter for this off of eBay. Poor little program, Turing machine, just couldn't quite clear the last gate, but we got it.
Right.
And what I've learned from that is that in our digital age, you can lie through a computer really easily. You can delete whole swaths of material, but on a typewriter, you have to think continuously. And the other thing, we're used to firing out our emails right now. Nobody takes time to think about anything. In these right. letters, he'd stop and start. These would take hours for him to create. And in between, he was hosting a lot of druggy friends and doing a lot of shooting and some traveling. And
it's interesting to think that if he didn't send those letters out compulsively, you know, and yet, you know, they're quite, they certainly have a impulsive quality about them, some of them.
He starts off 1968 in a pretty bad state. The Hell's Angels almost beat him to death out here right. at the Oakland Club. He had the incredibly bad sense to harangue a guy named Junkie George, and who was he was considered one of the more uncontrollable guys on that squad.
Right.
I mean, if you can picture the Hell's Angels having guys on there that even they admit are uncontrollable.
Yeah,
you
know? Actually, I lived up.
I've run into a couple of those.
I lived up the street from the Hell's Angels, and most of them actually were kind of mellow. But
I like the Hell's Angels myself. Yeah. I was just hanging out with a couple last night over right. In the Mission. But anyway, I don't really share Thompson's view on them. And but he quipped something to Junkie George, who smacked around his wife and kicked his dog across a fireplace, that only punks did that. And Junkie George leaned into him. And once one Hell's Angel is on you, the rest will fall. And
right.
so will you.
Right.
And it was only through the grace of a man nicknamed Tiny, who was massive, that he hauled Thompson out of there and got him out.
Well, I've heard of Tiny, actually.
Yeah.
Kind of a legendary figure among the Ken Kesey crowd. And
yeah, yeah. He did some of those trips down there. And but anyway, he nearly gets beaten to death by them, pretty much flees San Francisco, and goes out to Colorado for his best friend's wedding, and they kind of fall in love with the whole outside Aspen area. But success for him meant getting sued almost immediately by publishers who pretty much wanted a settlement agreement that would chain him to a typewriter for them.
I mean, a lot of the stuff, listening to your play and also reading some of his notes, a lot of his anger and a lot of his juice came from just being really a pissed off writer. Pissed off at the mainstream publishing, pissed off about not getting paid, pissed off about, you know, not having his stuff published in full, all that kind of stuff.
That was part
he was
of
a
it.
Warrior for writers. Really.
Well, he was, but at the same time, you can't. I think it does a disservice to someone like Thompson to classify them as chronically pissed off. the top of my bong used to read, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. And I still firmly believe that. The 90s were horrific for us, and so were the late 60s for that same kind of attitude in San Francisco. He hated hippies.
Right.
And because they weren't doing anything. There were other radicals around here, like the Diggers and a couple other groups in the area, SDS, and, well, they were more militant, but people who really were fomenting change. And the hippies were just lazy, he thought.
Right.
So the thing that was driving him in early 68 is he couldn't come up with a new idea. He didn't know where he was going.
Well, there was the Lyndon Johnson book, and then...
well, that was part of the settlement agreement from the court cases. There was, he was going to do that, the Rum Diary, and then he had sold them on the idea of something called the Death of the American Dream. And Lyndon checks out after Walter Cronkite took a piss on him, as he should have, because Vietnam was going horribly wrong at that time, and
right.
Johnson was on the George Bush agenda of send more troops, it will all work out. And... when Lyndon Johnson found out that Walter Cronkite wouldn't support him, he said, if I don't have Cronkite, I don't have America. And he ducked out of the race right then and there. And that cost Thompson about $10,000, which in today's money would be about $80,000, $90,000. And he very much needed the money.
Shit. So, and, I mean, he didn't feel like he could just go ahead and write a book about Johnson after he bugged out.
You know, aside from...
he didn't know back then that Johnson killed Kennedy.
Yeah.
Well, Johnson was the grassy knoll. Johnson was the grassy knoll.
Yeah, I think he was.
And J. Edgar Hoover's the shrubs. But, no, I mean, with the classical exception of maybe Richard Nixon, nobody really wants to read about a loser after the fact,
right.
Especially one as tepid as Lyndon Johnson. I mean, Johnson really kind of takes power in the tremendous shadow of Kennedy assassinations.
Right.
And it's not like he was a populist or, I mean, another drawling Texan.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great personality moment. It was when he showed everybody a scar. He kind of pulled his pants a little ways down and showed off his scar. No, maybe not a lot of juice. He got a lot of juice off.
I don't think I'll be able
his,
to have sex for the next week after you saying that. It was a terrible vision.
Beautiful. It's
Lyndon
a
Johnson
beautiful
on crack.
Thing.
That's awful. But the death of the American dream becomes his obsession at that time, and he could see things going just horribly wrong. Presenting the Richard Nixon doll overhauled 1968 model,
right.
He pretty much lays out the roadmap for why the Democrats are going to fail in 1968. And
this is before the Chicago Convention.
Yeah, which was another galvanizing point for
that
him.
That sort of guaranteed that the Democrats would fail.
He, well, that was the big face-off, and we make a big issue of that in the play. That was one of the first things in the script that came to me, was this was a humongous turning point for him. He'd pretty much socked himself into Woody Creek and wasn't going anywhere really, but he read tremendously. His inventory and bill for magazines and publications to Random House, his publishers, is 20 or 30 publications long, newspapers, magazines, and he didn't just read one stripe. It's not as though he read just Time and the Left Wing stuff.
Right.
He wanted to know what the other side was thinking.
He was a political junkie. He was a mainstream political junkie in the sense that, I mean, he followed it the way he loved sports and he loved
He was a pragmatic
electoral
realist.
Politics.
A pragmatic realist. He very much wanted to see America succeed on the promise of America, hence the American dream. And he wasn't trying to define that for anyone. He just didn't want to see us get perverted by people who were really just using us and selling us their version of the American dream. And this becomes a very heavy point with him. But when he goes to Chicago, he had originally wanted to pull a sort of Dan Rather and go around, see the delegates and, you know, witness.
Right, he went as a reporter for who?
It wasn't a reporter. He went to Random House. He bugged Jim Soberman for months to get him credentials.
Right.
And so, but the thing is that he realized going into this that the convention itself was largely irrelevant, and what was going to happen there was a pretty good-sized battle. Everybody
right.
was coming.
Right.
And he gets there to find out that, you know, Richard J. Daley was not a slouch. This is Chicago we're talking about. This is not like showing up in Cleveland, you know, or Sacramento. Well, Sacramento was a
They had just shot to kill in a race riot, actually, before the Chicago convention.
Well,
they'd... actually shot to kill in a black race riot. So
yeah, I mean, he owned that fucking place. I mean, there was no doubt about it.
No, And I mean, this is the old school Democrats. You know, my grandfather worked for a steel mill, and when they were on strike, the mob would come in and try to break the strikes down.
Right.
So when you're in a tough industrial production area like that, Democrats were not, you know, the spineless creatures of today. These were people who, you know, lifted bricks, worked steel, built cars, and would do it to it if you tried to screw with them.
Right.
And
they were going to put up with a bunch of flower punks.
Well, the thing was that it was a schism in the Democratic Party at the time. And that's, you know, the tremendous youth movement that came largely from California and kind of fanned out from there.
Right.
And so you've got these older liberals there whom Thompson would later come to absolutely detest for their uselessness. You know, people who went ahead and they had the baby and they built the family business and now they're very comfortable in here and can't change too much.
Right.
So it's this kind of uneasiness between the two parts of the Democratic Party, the young people who want to really reinvigorate this, end the war, and make turn America away from this travesty. And then you've got the older people there who a lot of their parents were World War II veterans. And so a little bit more of a conservative Democratic feel there, too.
And the maybe, Teamsters, basically.
Jingoism isn't just limited to our generation. Back then, communism was a very real thing that people were very frightened of.
And also, the Southern Democrats, many of them were still segregationists. So you had that aspect of it as well.
Well, there's a reason why hurricanes continue to pound certain areas of the South. God likes it that way.
Yeah. Let's hear a few minutes from your play, if we could.
The blowback from the mayor's race was pretty catastrophic. I was no longer a fellow among the people. Instead, I'd become a dangerous freak among the misfits. Communist! Dope fiend! Motherfucker! Most commonly, all three at once. Thompson, you communist dope fiend motherfucker! Certain people who had once called themselves my friends and allies now said openly that Aspen and Woody Creek in general would be far better off if I met with some hideously violent fate that Hell's Angels would do for free. Those treacherous cocksuckers would have to come up here and get me first. Randomly firing the .44 at the gongs I had mounted on the ridgecrest kept any such fuckers from thinking that was a realistic possibility. Besides, it's not like I'm a journalistic recluse anymore. Whereas Playboy and Esquire may have cut me off at the knees, Warren Hinkle has decided to give me a platform from his new magazine, Scanlon's Monthly. Even when he lopped off entire sections of my NRA and Kille pieces, I was still able to take a head-on run at the fatback bastards who have almost done this entire country in. The money was pretty good, kept things around here relatively fluid, that is, when they actually paid me. You see, Warren's intentions were noble. But he has absolutely no idea how to conduct national distribution or spur an expanding subscriber basis. I feared the entire thing was going to go down in flames, owing me a ton of money in the process.
Great. I hope maybe we can get Hinkle in here sometime, although he's not known for showing up.
You know what? I'll invite Diana Greer. He'll come. They deserve each other, really.
Yeah, no, in a strange way, I like Warren. Let's break and... hear a tune, and we'll be right back with B. Gonzo, or B. Duke.
Come on now.
back with a B. Duke. Is this writing basically you trying to do the voice of Hunter S. Thompson?
No.
Are you incorporating his stuff? Is it all him?
No.
How does it all work?
I realized what I had originally intended to do was to take certain passages of Fear and Loathing in America and kind of knit them together.
Right.
And I quickly abandoned that because I knew it wasn't going to work and we would run afoul of copyright issues with the estate. Right. His widow, I don't really care for. She's offended his son Juan, and she's done several stupid things that I really detest. And so I didn't want to put more, you know, gasoline on the fire in that direction, and so I dropped back. And unlike Johnny Depp or Bill Murray, I didn't have the luxury of moving into Thompson's house and, you know, getting the Haunter experience. I'd already shot explosives on acid and, you know, done a lot of acid and really loved it. And I thought, well, you know, I should really look into this. And as I did more research, it was the political things that he did that really caught my attention. And what I did at that time was I live alone, so I had a great luxury of time to myself to do this. And I really kind of dropped back and absorbed him through his letters and went back and reread things that I had read before in the context of the letters to get the complete effect and really allowed him to take over myself. And I spent a lot of time with my eyes closed imagining the world as he was going out to see it. And it was very easy to translate elements of that frustration, the Vietnam War to the Iraq War. Spineless, useless Democrats to spineless, useless Democrats. Vile Republicans to vile Republicans.
Right.
Oil companies, fucking everybody. Yeah, I'm sorry, can I say that on right, internet?
Say anything you want, yeah.
Wonderful. Fuck Howard Stern. Anyway, I realized that I couldn't just try to sound like him. I had to reach in and find that, you know, that agony. And I knew there was something in there that no one was really getting to because we're all fascinated with the myth, you know.
Right.
The gonzo maniac. And I've been accused of being that many times, and I don't even hire a lawyer anymore. I just, you know, tell them to give me the fine and pay it off and keep going. But, you know, at the core, even our most outlandish people, with the possible exception of Paris Hilton and Barbara Streisand, are real people. And I knew that was in Thompson, and when I started to find out more about his personal life, I could see where that pain was coming from. And his wife had two miscarriages, one at 4 months and 6 months, both in 1968. And in 1969, she delivered a stillborn daughter. And
that plays into your piece, actually.
Oh, yes, it does.
Yeah,
we went for the man, not, you know, the myth. Everybody knows the myth.
Did you have any trepidation about trying to put this out? I mean, in terms of a responsibility towards him as a man?
I wouldn't say trepidation so much because I knew what we were going for, and my my cohorts in this were very patient with me in letting me get this together on a natural line, and a very kind of organic line too. There was none of this, you know, must meet milestone A to get to milestone B. We didn't work that way. But what I was really concerned about was having to experience all of that pain. And the process of writing this script up until the point where I got the Selectric was nothing but agony and misery, and it hurt all the time. And my wonderfully supportive girlfriend caught me after a particularly tough weekend. In the play, we have a section where he just totally loses his mind. After the stillborn baby, he really did. If you had given Hunter Thompson the button to blow up the world at that time, he'd have pushed it.
Right.
He was very blackened and just torn horrifically. And so I had to find out.
During this time in his life, was he doing a lot of the drugs that he's famous for?
He was doing a lot of speed at the time.
Uh-huh.
And he'd laid off the LSD a bit and was trying to get peyote every now and then. But the speed actually came from a nuclear lab in New York where his wife Sandy had been a secretary, and those poor scientists were paid so badly they started producing methamphetamine.
That nuclear crank is the best shit, man.
Well, I think that's why he really didn't like the Hell's Angels so much, they were still fucking around with Benzedrine and fusion power.
Cheap but, crank. I mean, you're not saying that.
Anybody, well, you know, crack's not as cheap as it used to be. If you've ever been around someone who takes speed, the roller coaster ride of the emotions that go through is pretty extreme.
I've been very close to someone who takes speed.
Yeah. In fact, you could argue that the ability to have some kind of grip on reality becomes
very strained.
Well, at least as tenuous as on LSD, I think. Well,
the thing is that Hunter was sleeping. A lot of speed freaks will go and go and go and go until they collapse in dehydration, starvation, exhaustion, and, you know, tweaker spun out. But he was sleeping every night, and Sandy took good care of him, and so he was keeping a different type of schedule. And let's not forget that we're talking about Hunter Thompson. The only other mutant I know like this is a man named Chris Radcliffe, who, if you've ever encountered him, hi, Chris, how are you, is a quantum impossibility and the only exception to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle that I know of.
Does he write? Because, I mean, it seems like the world is starving for...
Chris is an extremely talented culture jammer currently residing in Portland, Oregon. You've all been warned. Yeah. But Thompson, he rode the ups and downs of this, and he did drink quite a bit. And so that had an impact. And, of course, being sort of sequestered with Sandy there the whole time was a compound misery. And he was from an age where men didn't really talk about their feelings. They kind of kept it locked up. He didn't believe in psychiatry. And he really kind of took it on his own. And here he is trying to grapple with all of this agony in his personal life. The country's disintegrating around him. He got the shit knocked out of him in Chicago by the police. Right. And started to feel like the whole nation was really slipping into a type of internal civil war bordering on anarchy.
Yeah, and I mean, he really felt it. He was not a cynic, actually.
He wasn't, and unlike Bob Dylan, who, if you watch No Direction Home, did not want to be the spokesman for a generation,
right?
Thompson was unafraid to do that. Thompson very much wanted to be one of the voices that helped things go the right way.
Mm-hmm. I think that maybe he felt like he was stepping... I'm not sure if he had such a hard-on for it so much as... if a bunch of idiots are going to go up and try to be the voice of his generation, well, fuck, he's going to have to come up and say something. I think he felt like...
I don't think that's true. I think as a journalist... No, I think as a journalist, he was very dedicated to that. And he had covered other very heavy things. He had been in South America for a time and had covered, you know, mayoral elections down there and riots and had been through New York and the Caribbean. And, I mean, he knew, you know... true toughness when he had to, and he was unafraid to go into it. And you got to remember, Thompson was like 6'5 and 185 pounds. He was monstrous.
No, but I mean, I think part of it was born of frustration in that there weren't a whole lot of strong voices that he agreed with.
He was close friends with Tom Wolfe and with Charles Corralt, actually.
And nobody quite put it into the package like he did, because I was actually somebody who would buy Rolling Stone and read it back when those articles came out. So I got the initial surprise of just like, wow, you know, this, and I think it was Fear and Loathing was the first one.
He and Hinkle and Ralph Steadman, when they hooked up, they pretty much made a pact to go ahead and rip these assholes out, and they wanted them gone. Now, I don't mean to say that he was ready to step up and become a John Lennon and that type. That's not true at all. But he was keenly aware of his ability to reach people and sway their minds, even on a one-on-one. And he was an ardent prankster and a total psych fucker. He really enjoyed that.
Right. I mean, there are a bunch of stories about him doing some crazy shit. Do you have any favorites?
My personal favorite is when his friend was living in New York on the fifth floor of a walk-up in Hell's Kitchen. Thompson goes over there to see him one day, and the guy's not home. And so Thompson gets bored, and so he takes a belt off. He starts smacking this wall with it, with all the windows open on like the fifth floor. Whack, whack, beg for it, bitch. Whack, whack, whack. Who's your daddy? Whack, whack, whack. You know. And so the neighbors get really distressed and they call the police. And the police storm the place and they come up there and they find Thompson sitting alone. Where's the other guy? What's going on here? I don't know what you're talking about. Who? What? Huh?
And you know, writing this, did you feel like you had to adopt his lifestyle at all?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I've been chain smoking Dunhill Reds since. October, and I told my friends and my family, my mother's very concerned about this, so is my grandmother and my girlfriend, that if the play continues to be a success, I will have to continue smoking. I don't smoke. And
what about all the other enjoyments? Had any adrenochrome? Did you bring any adrenochrome with you?
My attorney's not as good as his.
Samoan?
Hey, he was Mexican, didn't he? No, my criminal attorney is a great guy and a white guy, and as far as I can tell, a straight guy, and... It's a tragedy. It is. Mark, I love you, but loosen up a little, huh?
How about Wild Turkey?
Absolutely. I've been drinking 101 pretty much rabidly for a while.
Ouch.
It's helping. I can tell. Get into the spirit of it. One of the things, I mean, just like...
smoking a lot of pot and taking acid. Is, yes.
that always helps too. One of the things I think of is like being able to read Fear and Loathing and all that stuff when it came out. It would be really hard to be a gonzo journalist right now. In terms of like mainstream publications and stuff like that, nobody lets you do it. The last one was sort of Lester Bangs was like the last
Matt
one to get away.
Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone is the heir apparent to Hunter Thompson.
Who is that?
Matt Taibbi. He is on the.
Well, maybe I haven't been reading it lately.
Yeah, I first noticed him about 2 years ago when he went to Burning Man and proclaimed it for exactly what it is, toothless and wallowing in its own muck and irrelevant to anyone or anything. Yeah. He, the next week, went out to New Orleans with Sean Penn, who was on some insane rescue mission for a single black woman in an underwater parish, and Taibbi goes with him into this destruction and filed an incredible story. He has since been in Washington ripping every single one of these vile greed heads that we love to hate. And he names the names. He tells you exactly who they are, what they're doing. He went into a Senate fundraiser for this one senator from Alaska, posing as a Russian oil company investment banker.
Oh.
And the company name he made up translated to oily fart gas. But, of course, this idiot Republican who doesn't speak Russian had no idea. And he really did kind of lay on the Thompson to go in and sort of invade this.
Well, it's great to know that somebody still has a spirit. Can you pronounce his name again?
Yeah, it's Taibbi, T-A-I-B-B-I, Matt Taibbi.
So, yeah.
But he doesn't do drugs as much as Hunter did, or at least if he does, he's
very quiet
about it. Well,
it's a different narrative, maybe, but it has some of the same aspects.
See, I kind of disagree with you, in that I think that if you had people who had the balls and the disposition to do it, that it would be easier to do it now than ever.
Well, I think if you know the magazine industry,
you're not headed for blogging, right?
I wasn't gonna say blogging in specific, but I think that
the magazine people are much more tight ass. Yeah,
of course
they
are, but
I'm surprised that Winter. I'm pleased to hear that Winter let somebody rip.
But there are other ways of reaching people that aren't mainstream. Sure, you can't be a gonzo writer and work for fucking Condé Nast or fucking whatever.
Condé Nasty.
Condé Nasty.
I know you love it. Condé Nasty.
But, I mean, does that mean you can't be one?
The other question is, does anybody do it well? What do you think about that? I mean, certainly lots of people try to mix the fiction and nonfiction and do wild drug tales and so forth, but who else does it well other than the fellow you just mentioned?
Well, you know, Arianna Huffington, when she finally saw the light and was forced to admit that our government was freely for sale, I sent her a letter. She and my father are friends. And I sent her a letter welcoming her to the punk rock club and recommended that she purchase Dead Kennedys albums and Black Flag and Circle right. Jerks and catch up on things. She never wrote back conspicuously. And with that due, come on. Anyway, I mean,
she could
go far with that dyed red job and just a little shave on the side. She could be hot. Think about it.
Yeah, I think
could be. I would bang the living crap out of her. I'd bang her so hard that fucking her old ex-husband would feel it.
Is that before or after Condoleezza Rice?
Oh, no.
I'd do them both at once.
Condoleezza Rice is the subject.
Well, how about that? How about a little salt and pepper?
This man may have bad feelings.
Condoleezza Rice needs a devoted line of slave boys under her desk to try to achieve the impossible, and that is an orgasm. If you can name a single member of the Bush administration known to have had an orgasm in the last 5 years, aside from Karl Rove on whores out on K Street, you know.
Well, what about that guy with the prostitute? A few of them have been with the prostitute.
How about Carrick? Bernard Carrick was a stud, man. He could have come in there and rocked the White House.
The New York City.
Yeah. He was banging Judith Regan.
He's
going to
be in the next administration, maybe.
Well, he had a wife, was banging Judith Regan, was banging a corrections officer.
Giuliani's quite a stud man, isn't he?
We're trying to set him up so that he'll become the Republican nominee and get Hillary and Barack together. Hillary's already kicked his ass once, and with Barack's funk soul brotherness on the entire thing, they can knock Giuliani out pretty easily. His photographs of September 11th mean a lot more. But getting back to what we're saying about being a gonzo journalist in the early 21st century, what it takes is guts. What it takes is dedication, and what it takes is belief. And so many writers, when they go out there was an interesting piece in Rolling Stone a couple years ago about how most journalism schools are turning their graduates towards marketing.
Yeah. Right.
And so, you know, journalism has always been right up there with teaching in terms of poverty. And but that's not true anymore. I mean, you know, journalists can make it, but it's also the willingness of all of these, as Thompson would have said it, castrated editors and publishers who are afraid to rock certain boats. There's some things you still don't go after. Why is it the GM produces the worst fucking vehicles on the planet, and every time someone mentions the word innovate, they all say, we'll have to fire our entire factory if you make us do something good.
And Lee Iacocca is a culture hero.
Yeah,
in the meantime,
a foregone memory, and no one will touch things like, you know, Westinghouse. And of course, with the brainwashing that the Bush administration put on all of us about with us or against us, people were genuinely afraid to step out. This was the most dangerous time since at least the McCarthy era for this country, where the backswing of the administration in terms of curtailing liberty, freedom, and free speech really did put a clamp down on all of us that was horrific. We're just now getting out from under that. And people are realizing what we've known in San Francisco for some time, and that is dissent is not un-American. Dissent is what makes us Americans, especially in times like these. But to get one person out there, you really have to go for it. I think maybe, who's that guy from
CNN? They've
got to
be good at what they do.
The young guy.
What's that?
I'm trying to think of, CNN's such a fucking shit pile right now.
They have somebody on CNN who's interesting?
Well, vaguely. You know, there's that blonde they purloined from MSNBC or whatever the hell she came from. They tried to sell her as a sex toy, but you know, I suppose she's good for something, but it's not news. I really want to do this guy justice, too, and I'm sorry I can't think of his name, but he, you know, he
was... You're talking about their star anchor dude? What's his name? The blonde guy who covered Katrina?
Anderson Cooper. I think Anderson Cooper's probably the closest, but even he isn't going to come anywhere near that. And we don't have anybody who really wants to really put it out there right now.
Here's why. You want to know what the fucking problem is with journalism right now? I'll fucking tell you. And I'll fucking, you snark right now, but
snark.
I'll fucking tell
one.
You.
Smirk or snark.
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 Snark is
right now.
Good one. I like that.
That nice.
I'll fucking,
what
are you all right?
I didn't know. That tasted foul.
You got some ashes
in
your
San Francisco water right there.
Well, I had San Francisco water. I don't know what that was. It says Sierra Nevada, which indicates Nevada, and that's always bad, especially for water.
Radiation.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what the fucking problem is. Two. And I know, because I've seen it. In journalism. One, Asian girls.
Oh, here we go again.
Paris Hilton.
Fucking Asian girls, man. And here's, but that's only a microcosm
Lindsay
of it.
Lohan.
That's a microcosm of it. Overall, the problem.
And non-sequiturs are out for the rest of the show. So there's
no, I'm sequiting.
What really sucks is when you see things that could happen, and they don't. I think the best thing that's happened for America is National Geographic's coverage of things like Islam and the war and trying to bring all of these things together, the recognition of Abraham as being the root of three religions that are currently at war with one another. That's not gonzo, but it's helping us get to where we need to be instead of this, you know, never-ending bloodletting. And for one person to be... There is no Gary Cooper for the journalism of this generation, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, first of all, it has to start in the schools. Someone has to... This is where Thompson's death could really help us out. Thompson is going to become a college course in places like Columbia.
All right.
You know.
And people are going to wonder, why can't we do this? I mean, there was a whole narrative around this idea of new journalism, which kind of disappeared.
My film theory professor at the University of Miami, a man named Bill Cosford, who was a living soul and a very good friend of mine, encouraged us all to think. When the first Gulf War started, he suspended film theory class and showed us the difference in just single words and the effect on the mind. Patriot versus Scud. Yeah. Sortie versus bombing or raid. Mm. And I was very touched by that. And Bill was very, very into, he was from that 60s generation. Loved, you know, the Doors and, you know, all of these trenchant questions coming out of people about what the fuck are we doing? And, what we need are a lot more professors like Bill Cosford, who unfortunately died of pneumonia in 1993, very young at 37. But professors need to be willing to take chances and to do more in the publish or perish environment than stroke their own egos. We're at war. Our country really is going to hell. And I had told people for a couple of years that I felt like it was the Roman Empire circa 425. One more venal or weak leader and we're done.
Well, I'm just going to put my finger down my throat, throw up, and then start eating some more food. But before we let you go, give us another piece of your act.
Sure. Let's see, where should we pull from? I really like the third act, in which there are three acts here before I go into this. 1968, 69, and 70 are one act each, and then 71 is just a very thin epilogue explaining why he didn't take... in fact, why don't we go for Ralph Steadman? This is from the epilogue of the show. Steadman's still recovering from that debacle in Newport at the America's Cup last year. We really went at it from all angles, including a rock band whose single at the time was Up Against the Wall, Motherfucker! Including Ralph on his first hallucinogens, and for his bravery, he was treated to a near hopeless flight from harbor police and private security as we tried to spray paint Fuck the Pope on a large yacht and were undone by steel balls in a spray can. I was using a flare gun to cover our asses for a graceful exit from this, and there's Ralph, barefoot and psychotic, ambling onto a plane for New York. His plan is to get to the Scanlon's offices and to sort of blend in with the other freaks and get some downtime, but he lands there, takes a cab to Scanlon's, and finds out that they are locked up tight. They'd folded the day before. I already knew that. But Ralph's mind was in such a delicate condition at the time that I couldn't tell him one last thing, and that would have been it, and he's far too valuable for future excursions, so I think I'm going to have to give him a pass on this one. I mean, last time I talked to him, he was still having severely debilitating flashbacks and hoping for a soon return to a relatively peaceful normalcy as much as Ralph really can. It's time to dial in the other hardcore pro. Oscar Zeta Acosta and I have been working both sides of this wretched street for years. He's the main engine in the Mexican Brown Power movement down in Los Angeles, an attorney of unflinching gall, hypnotic oratory, and the will to do what the other guy won't every single time. He can shut down large stretches of that vast nightmarish metropolis by calling for a one-day strike among the Latinos. And yet, he's under the delusion that he can build a country where freaks like us are safe from prosecution as he settles into a tweed and loafer's existence as a UCLA law professor. Oh yeah, we've traded barbs over who's the bigger sellout, co-opted into a comfortable existence just outside the wires. But being called an infantile anarchist by that Mexican dunce with the morals of a goat, that was the last straw. It's time to call that rotten little spick on his shit, haul his ass out of Los Angeles into a place where he cannot escape the overwhelming filth that is America. Las Vegas is neutral territory for both of us. Neither one of us has any connections there or any clout that's going to count for anything other than a quick getaway if we need it.
Thank you, B. Duke. Once again, the show is Gonzo, a Brutal Chrysalis. And are there any shows coming up? First of all, tell us where you've performed and if you have anything coming up.
We opened at The Climate on January 5th and did the whole month there, and a very successful run. A few sellout shows and very good attendance, very well received. We did a second run there in March to pick up the people who missed us the first time. We just got back from Portland, a fantastic city, great theater town, and we are going to Seattle in July, and we are going to Los Angeles in September.
Cool.
We're hooking up with venues right now, but those will be the next places. Anybody who's interested in checking us out, we have a website called GonzoDuke, GonzoDuke.com, where they can see some clips from the show and get a feel for what we're doing and find out where we're at.
All right, and of course, we'll have links to his website at areyouseriousradio.com. And I do want to tell you that come back next week where we'll have Justin. What the hell is his last name? Justin Cho, I think.
Is that Justin TV?
Justin Tan, yeah. Cho Tan.
Yeah. Is that the guy from Justin TV?
Justin Timberlake.
The man from Justin TV. So
Justin Timberlake. Could
check
be
us out.
A far more pornographic experience.
Love's the only weapon. Shit!
Are you serious?